Okay, so I just asked you off if you would share a little bit about his actually personal story. You know, what it's like to be here as an Israeli living in this land. We've all had, you know, experiences now to see how much God is involved in just being here. And I thought it would be really nice to hear what it was like to grow up here and how you feel about being here.
Okay, maybe they don't. Maybe they think we're in En Gedi.
Oh. I think they don't know where we are.
I didn't know we were out.
I told everybody we were here, so
no,
it,
they don't know where.
Yeah.
I didn't get the memo.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Skip.
Yeah.
So right. So Skip asked me to address, you know, my, I would say, angle, my perspective of God in my life on a daily basis. Maybe also as an example of an Israeli, though. I must say ahead of time, I don't like to take myself as an example to anyone but myself. So I'm not kind of like on behalf of anyone else. And you should know, on a personal note, that many of my friends think I'm crazy. And they're right. So if every two Jews have three different opinions, obviously me and my friends have also various opinions and debates and arguments. Which is great, because us Jews, we like to argue. That's what we like to do. It's in a way to brainstorm. So when Skip asked me to do this, I'll level with you. I have no idea in which direction this will go. I'm not one that stands in front of the mirror or even has a plan of what to say at every single moment. But thank God, earlier this morning with Moshe, there was a question that was asked towards the very end. And I think I'm going to pick up from that question as if I were asked that question. And the question was, how did you come in terms with God, or how did you find God? And I'm taking that question as if I was asked that question. And I'm going to say something, and I hope I don't hurt anyone's feelings. And I hope that I will be understood the way I want to be understood. Because maybe the way I'll phrase it and maybe the way I'll word it will not be exactly what I meant, will not be heard the way I wanted it to be heard. But yet, nevertheless, I like to say what I think and think what I say. So, keeping that question kind of like in the air, I'm going to go on another angle, and then I'll come back to that particular question. And I'll share with you that, obviously, you guys know I'm a tour guide. I guide many different groups. Not all groups are the same. And there are some groups sometimes, for instance, that are younger people, younger children, teenagers or young adults. And I must say I have a totally different approach. I'm like tough with these people. I'm not like the Yoav that you know, right? I keep them on a strict, I'm like Skip. On a strict schedule, on a tight schedule, and the first day, the first 24 hours, I don't even smile once. Kind of like very tough. And those people are afraid of me sometimes. There are. They respect me. And they're even sometimes even afraid of me. But even more so, if I'll take it one step forward, in the military, for instance, in the army, I was and still am, in a certain ways, in the reserves, a commander. And I remember when I was, constantly in the army, my mandatory service as an officer, and those soldiers, some of which were officers that were under my command, were afraid of me. They were literally afraid of me because, of course, the military does that, right? Yet, my two very beloved, precious, beautiful children, my son and my daughter, of which I love more than anything in the world, and everyone, you can, you know, we all know that feeling. You can only have that feeling once you become a parent, right? My son and daughter, of which I have so much, I respect them so much, and in a way, they're walking, they're following the steps that I wanted them to follow, thank God. Yet my children are not afraid of me. They respect me to a certain extent, sometimes not, but they're not afraid of me, right? And that's like, it's amazing where like this 16-year-old boy who's now 16, but when he was 14 years old, he wasn't afraid of me yet. This 25, 27-year-old officer, okay, captain, is afraid of me. And why is that? That is because my children shouldn't be afraid of me. They're not afraid of me because they're my children. And there is a certain relationship there. They know other angles of me that my soldiers and officers will, or people that I guide will never know. How does that have to relate to the question I asked earlier? I hope I'm not shattering any concepts or any things, the myths that people had. But at least when it comes to me, I'm talking on behalf of Yoav Brook and on behalf of Yoav Brook only. I'm not afraid of God. I've never felt a fear in the sense of how I was afraid of my commanders from God. And I hope I will be understood the way I want to be understood, but I myself, I was born into this. I was born here in Israel, and soon I'll relate to that as well, because it adds a lot to be born here and raised here my entire life. I was born into it. It's kind of like it's a no-brainer in a way. It's kind of like I take it for granted, for better and for worse. It's part of my life 24/7, at least for me. And so in a sense, there is it loses that fear, if you wish, or the distance from God. God is not, for me at least, God is in my life at all times. Regardless to me following or not following the words of the Torah, which I won't claim to say that I am, or I'm not following all the words of the Torah, right? And of the sages and the things that I was brought up and the things that I was educated, the way I was taught when I was a child. Yet, the sense and the essence, I would say even more so, of God, and you will, excuse me if I change the name, instead of saying God, I'll say Hashem or Elohim, is in my life on a daily basis. And was always in my life. And I never had, thank God, I must say, I never had the feeling, and maybe I'm missing out on something, of questioning, of needing to actually come in terms with God or find God in my life. So if I were to ask that particular question, which is a very good question, I'm not saying the question is invalid, I would say that question does not relate to me. I'm not a person to ask that particular question because I've never had the need to come in terms with God. I never felt distant away from God. And to try and give an example of how that works on a daily basis, I will relate, and it just so happens to be that we are on the eve of the Independence Day of the State of Israel. I will relate to the issue of, concept of miracles, of the work of God, in the hand of God in our lives, in my life at least. I remember a few years back, as I already mentioned, I have arguments, discussions, debates with my personal friends, of course, and so they don't see the same way I see, obviously. All right, we have different opinions, so I'm not representing any other Israeli but myself. But I remember a few years back, I had a certain debate, one of my friends, argument. And he said to me, you know, he said to me, why do you think it is that once we read in the Bible, we read in the Torah, we read in the Tanakh, sometimes even in the Midrash, all right, of miracles that have occurred, of the hand of God, of seeing the hand of God, of miracles that he does in his world. Why don't we see any of these miracles today? Why did it all of a sudden stop? Why do you think it stopped? And I looked at my friend, and I said to him, you know, this was about 2 or 3 years back, maybe 4 years ago. Yeah, it was 4 years ago. And the reason I now remember why it was 4 years ago was that 2 weeks before this had happened, before this question or this discussion, debate, argument that we had, my friend and I, 2 weeks beforehand, I found a picture, a photo of my grandmother, who is an Auschwitz-Birkenau survivor and was liberated in Bergen-Belsen. By the Americans. I found a photo of her after a very long research that I've done that And it was 100% her. We did all the everything that needed to be done of my grandmother as a 23-year-old on the day of liberation of Bergen-Belsen camp on May 15th, 1945. And that was about 2 weeks before I was asked that question or challenged with that statement of a friend of mine. So I said to my friend, you know, you're saying there are no miracles. Open your eyes, because I see miracles all the time. You think that if I were to come to my grandmother on May 15th, 1945, on the day of liberation of Bergen-Belsen camp, and if I were to say to my grandmother, look, in 3 years' time exactly, on May 15th, 1948, the Jews will have their state of their own, and they will defeat seven nations that will attack them, and they will be so successful, no one would have believed me. My grandmother and any other survivor of the Holocaust, yeah, not to mention, of course, if I were to say those words in the 30s of the 20th century, right? In 10 years' time, 20 years' time, there's going to be a state that will be named the State of Israel, a Jewish state. If I were to say that to anyone, they would mock me. They would laugh at me. They would say, that's a fantasy. You are a dreamer, or maybe you should see a psychiatrist, all right? Because it's ridiculous. That cannot happen. It's just, you wouldn't be able to see it. And it happens. And I said to my friend, how can you not open your eyes and see a miracle? And miracles occur. You just have to open your eyes. And for me, again, I'm taking the example of 1948 simply because that was the answer I answered, and simply because we are on the eve of the Independence Day, so I think it connects. But again, it's a matter, at least for me, on a personal level. It's on a daily basis, it's what I live. It's where I am. I was born into it. In a way, I know I was lucky that I was born into it, and therefore I never felt, and hopefully I will never feel it in the future, the need to question, I would say, where is God? How did you, Yoav, come in terms of God? Where, or how, and when, and how did you find God in your lives? I never had that question, for better and for worse. Maybe it's not good that I never had that challenge, that question, but I never felt it. It's just, like I said to you, like my kids know that I exist because I'm their parent, and they don't fear me. They have a certain relationship with me, as opposed to my soldiers. They don't have a certain relationship with me, and they're afraid. There is some sort of distance between us, and there's fear. I don't feel distance or fear from God. If I were to tell someone, again, I'm giving the same example, that on the day of the establishment of the State of Israel, for instance, on May 15th, 1948, David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister who just now declared the independence and established this state, all right, he asks to know from his commanders, what are the, because seven nations have invaded Israel that very day, seven nations, seven armies of states, what do we have to fight against them? There was no yet IDF, by the way. IDF will be formed only a month later. David Ben-Gurion receives a telegram at 2 a.m. on a Shabbat morning, okay, Saturday, on the night between Friday and Saturday of May 15th, 1948, a telegram that tells him we have the following. This might sound as a joke, but it's real. We have two planes and three tanks. That's what we have. The Egyptians attack that very night from the south. Only the Egyptians, which is one out of seven nations, had 300 planes and 1,200 tanks. There were the Jordanians, the Lebanese, Syria, Iraq, forces from Libya and Saudi Arabia. And here he is. There's this guy named David Ben-Gurion, and there's a nation of 600,000 Jews who are fighting with two tanks and with two planes and three tanks. By the way, we lose a plane the following day. On Saturday morning, we lost one plane, and 2 days later, we lost a tank. At the end of this war, a few months later, Israel defeats its enemies. And we have an armistice agreement with these enemies. Now, we Jews, we celebrate Hanukkah every year for 2,000 years now because the Maccabees fought against the Greeks and defeated the Greeks, even though the Maccabees were few and the Greeks were many. if you ask me, and that was a miracle, right? We celebrate a miracle. If you ask me, the 1948 is a much greater miracle than the story of Hanukkah. And if I could apply to what Moshe said earlier this morning, maybe it's even a bigger miracle than the very Exodus from Egypt. And maybe that's what is the quotation of what Moshe was reading this morning from Isaiah, if I'm not mistaken, the prophecy of Isaiah, if I am not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, that I will know that I shall no longer be the God known as the God who delivered my children out of Egypt, but the God who delivered my children from the lands of the north, the countries of the north, and so on and so forth. This is happening. This is what I said to my friend, but this is not what I'm saying to myself as well. This is happening in front of my eyes. I am living in an era where 66 years after the, where 70 years after the most horrific events ever took place, especially to my people, where 6 million of my people were wiped out, 66, 70 years later, I'm living in a country which is one of the most successful countries in the world. Yes. That's a miracle. That's not because the Jewish people are so great. I don't think that. It's not because the Jewish people are so great. It's not because the Jewish people are smarter than others. I don't think that. It's not because we're more righteous than others. I don't think that either, unfortunately. We should be a light to the nations, but we're not always that. We can defeat seven nations with two tanks and three planes and three tanks only and one and only if God is fighting that war. There is no other way. It just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. And by the way, I'm saying this as a secular Jew. You should know that David Ben-Gurion himself, Moshe Dayan, who was mentioned today, and others who were totally secular. They were well-informed, by the way. They were learned. They're intellectual. They learned the Tanakh. They knew the Tanakh very well. They loved the Tanakh. Ben-Gurion was in love with the Tanakh. He knew it by heart, by the way, the whole Tanakh. And Moshe Dayan was in love with the Tanakh, all these figures. But they were not religious. They were definitely not Orthodox Jews, but they were not really religious Jews. Yet, when they were asked these questions also in the late 40s, they all said the same. This is a miracle. There's no other way to explain how these things occurred in 1948. And if you ask me, there's no other way to explain of a lot of things that have occurred since then. And I actually personally see it on a daily basis in front of my eyes. Very similar to what Moshe said today. So to summarize that particular, I would say, first chapter in a way, that question. And again, it might come as a disappointment, but I've never found God because I've never actually searched. I've never felt that I need to search for God. I feel it 24/7. It's what I was born into, which takes me to another step that I want to share. And that is, there is a difference, I think, when a person is born in the land of Israel. And I'm referring currently specifically to Jews that are born in the land of Israel. And this, in the land of Israel, in this era, when there is a dependence of the state of Israel, of a Jewish state. Bob and I had this conversation a few days ago, and it has to do with starts from the small details. Even celebrations of holidays. There is a difference here. I'm going to give another example, and I hope, again, I'm not stepping on anyone's toes, and I hope I will be understood the way I want to be understood. And please forgive me if I say anything that might be offending in any way. This might sound as a weird example, a funny example, but I like this example. You know, when you go to a certain interview, or you go out, okay, on a date, for instance, or you're, you know, at a certain place, you're at work, you dress a certain way, right? But when you're at home, you allow yourselves to walk in your boxers. And you allow yourself to feel much, I would say, you know, loosened, right? It's my place. I can do, this is my place. Here I don't have to dress up. Here I don't have to put on my makeup. And here I don't have to, it's my place. I can feel comfortable in my place. I think the same happens to Jews in Israel, when it comes specifically to the need of, for instance, a synagogue. This might sound as a disappointment, but I don't think, I seriously, I don't attend synagogue that often. I don't feel the need. I think that if I were to live not in Israel, I might have felt the need more than I feel it here for a certain kind of like congregation of where I could relate to my beliefs as a Jew. Here in Israel, I don't feel I need it. My children, I don't think my children need it in a way that was, and also won't probably need the world, the whole entire vast world of halacha, again, for better or for worse, because we're living it. I'm in Israel. I'm in my house. Here I can feel free and loosen in a way to live, to actually speak this language, which, by the way, the language, speak the language of the Hebrew man. There's a famous song today known as Speak the Language of the Hebrew Man. If you listened to MTV, you probably heard it so many times. Language of the Hebrew man. Hebrew is a miracle, by the way, of itself. No one spoke Hebrew. If you were under the impression that Jews spoke Hebrew throughout 2,000 years, that is wrong. Jews did not speak Hebrew. Jews knew Hebrew, learned Hebrew, used Hebrew for prayers and sometimes for reading of the Torah, of course, in the synagogue and for studying the Torah, but not, for instance, for the Talmud most of it is Aramaic. Hebrew was not a spoken language up to the late 19th century. No one spoke it. It is a miracle. It is thanks to a certain person named Eliezer ben Yehuda, who decided, I'm going to take this language and make it a living language again. And people mocked him at the beginning and laughed at him and said, you're crazy. It's thanks to that guy, but it's not that guy who did it. It's God who did it. This language is, again, a living language. People speak it on a daily basis today without even thinking, all right, because they were born into it, such as your humble servant myself. I was born into it without even thinking of the fact that only less than 100 years ago, no one spoke this language on the street as a language that is spoken. It was only a language that you read from a siddur, from a prayer book, or from the Torah. It's a miracle. These are miracles. A language that was, in a way, dead and comes back is resurrected. The language is literally resurrected. For me, that is a miracle. So every single time I say a word in Hebrew, I sing a word in Hebrew, even if I'm bad-mouthing in Hebrew, right? I'm speaking a miracle. I'm part of a certain miracle. That's the way I see it. Now, of course, I don't walk 24 hours a day feeling, oh, I'm living a miracle, because one cannot do that and shouldn't do that. It's overwhelming, and again, you take it for granted. It's something I do. It's something I personally feel on a daily basis, simply because I was lucky enough. Thank God. Again, I'm thanking God for this, to be born into this. I know that I could have easily be not born into this. And I'm grateful for that every day. But I live it. It's part of my life. I breathe it. It's like air, for me at least. The presence of God in my personal life. If I had to try and like say, then what is the biggest, I would say, what's the most meaningful moment for you? If I were asked, what is the most meaningful moment for you with God? I will say that I will take one sentence from the Torah, of which I already said a few times on this trip, and mention it, that I personally, as Yoav Bruk, and I know of many, this time I could say, I know I represent many, because I know friends of mine, and I see it among Israelis, that this sentence, this verse, is in a way, I feel the essence, the very essence of who I am as a Jew and what is expected of me as a Jew. And the sentence, the verses, I mentioned it several times, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, Adonai is our Lord, our God. Adonai is one. Deuteronomy chapter 6. I say that verse twice a day, every morning when I wake up. I wash myself, I clean myself, and I find the time, no matter how busy I am, even if it's in the midst of a war, and I mean it, even in war, in harsh times that I personally went through, find the time to sit down, to concentrate, to say it as slow as I can. In times of war, I didn't really have a lot of time, but on a daily basis to sit down, to say that. I say that verse very slowly, simply because I'm thinking of lots of things and it takes a lot of energy for me, I must admit. But I do it once in the morning and I do it once at night just before I go to sleep. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. There are a lot of images I must share with you that run through my mind when I say it. Some of the images are images that happen every single time I say it. One of which is an image of which, of course, I've never seen, because I was not alive at the time, but it's kind of like this, you know, this vivid image you have of things that have occurred in the past. And I see in front of my eyes Rabbi Akiva, of which we spoke about, who was executed in the city of Caesarea at the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And as the Talmud says, when he is executed, the Romans were ripping his skin off his body, which was the most harsh way of executing in Rome. Worse than crucifixion. It's a slower form of death, unfortunately. And he's losing his blood, and he calls and he cries out, happy, and he's happy, and he's, at least that's what the Talmud says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, and his students are like, what's wrong with you? And he says to them, you know, all my life, I've never understood what it meant that you have to be devoted to God even if your life is taken. Now, I have the very opportunity to do so. The only opportunity to be devoted even, I won't miss this opportunity. Of course, I don't know if this conversation really happened between them, but that's the idea of the story that the Talmud is trying to tell, the Midrash is trying to tell us. That, and that's the image I kind of like try to have in my eyes. That even if his life is taken, if your life is taken from you, you call the Shema Yisrael. And for me, every morning when I say it, every night when I say it, one of the images is that. Not, God forbid, that I'm awaiting or asking to be in the spot of Rabbi Akiva. Hopefully not. But really feeling the essence of what is Hashem, what is Elohim in my life is something that is essential to my life on a daily basis, twice at least, if not more, at least twice a day. There are a few other images that I see in front of my eyes every morning when I wake up, and every night when I go to sleep, which also have to do with this sentence, with this verse. When I was 18 years old, I did not join the Israeli army. When I finished high school, I postponed my army service by a year. Actually, at the end of the day, it will be a year and a half. And I went to a certain yeshiva, kind of like a Jewish academy. This is an option. People can do this, all right? You don't get a certificate for this. You go just for the purpose of studying Torah and Talmud and other things, by the way. Not only Torah and Talmud, Jewish philosophy. And also for preparing physically, also on a physical and also on a spiritual and emotional level for the military service. It's named Mechina in Hebrew, which means a prep, okay, a prep academy, a prep yeshiva for the army. We were about 100 guys there, all 18 years old. And we were divided into kind of like sections or classes, and every class is divided into couples known as chavrutas. The couples, so there are about 5 classes and about 10 chavrutas per class because we were about 100 people. The chavruta, the two guys, they share dorms together at the yeshiva, at this particular place where we were, which is a settlement in the West Bank named Eli. And what we do is every morning we study together. All the morning we study usually Talmud together, and then only the two of us, one-on-one, kind of like debating with each other, trying to, I would say, follow the ways of the sages, okay, having debates among us. And then the afternoon, usually what happens on a daily basis is the 10 chavrutas get together in a classroom of 20, and there's the rabbi, okay, the teacher, who reviews the subjects that we were studying together. And I shared my chavruta with a guy I met a few years back, 3 years before then, as we were in the same youth movement, but he was living in Ra'anana, a suburb of Tel Aviv, and I was living in Jerusalem, of course, in Yerushalayim. And we were Chavruta. His name, Roi. Roi Klein. Hashem Yikom Damo. Roi and I were very, very good friends. We became very, very close friends, actually best of friends, preparing for the army together, preparing, learning, studying, debating, arguing, laughing, doing what 18-year-old boys, kids do, right? Sharing dorms. And there was a very strong, strong connection between us. And actually, there was a very strong connection between six of us. We were like a gang of six guys. Years go by, he joins the army, I join the army, we go our different ways, he goes to his unit, I go to my unit. But a few years later, I married, and so did he, and so did a few others. By the way, we married when we were in the military service, we married very young, all of us. And we all came back to that very settlement and lived together in that settlement named Eli. We're kind of like a gang of guys and young couples. And years go by. I'm going to fast forward this. Years go by. I already left my military service, and so did others. But a few stayed, among them Roi, who was an excellent, excellent commander and officer on all levels. And on all levels, literally, this guy was an incredible, in a very important, special combat unit. At any rate, we meet together every few weeks, every few Saturdays. He comes back home at this time, at this stage. I already have kids. He already has kids. Others have kids. We guys, on a Saturday afternoon, of course, he was, and so was I at the time, not ultra-Orthodox, but Orthodox people. We live in a settlement that is an Orthodox settlement, so we follow a certain way of life. And on a Saturday afternoon, usually what would happen is that the guys would get together, right, and sit on one of the balconies and, you know, talk among ourselves, and the wives would get together and do what wives do when they get together. And every single time, you know, us guys sitting together, he would come every second or third Shabbat because he doesn't come home every single day. He's an officer. He's still a commander in this combat unit. We talk, and we all talk about our daily life, right? This guy's complaining about his job, and this guy's complaining about his wife, and that guy's complaining about his boss, and we're talking. And Roi is talking about what happens in his life. Of course, he's a commander. And Roi, something very essential about him, this is what all the friends constantly say about him. He always spoke about his soldiers, but he never related to his soldiers. He never said the word in Hebrew. Of course, we all speak in Hebrew. He never said the word, my soldiers. He named them. Any ideas what he named them when he was speaking, when he related to them? When he spoke about his soldiers? My children. Exactly. Hayeladim sheli. He would always say Hayeladim sheli instead of Hachayalim sheli. My children. Now, okay, we it's a matter of speak. But it's not only a matter of speak, and soon you'll understand where I'm heading with this. Because we're all parents, and we all know that there is nothing in the world a parent won't do for his or her children. And that was Roi. Those were his children. Of course, he had three or two beloved children back home with his beautiful wife. And then later on, he will have a third child as well, who's going to have an eighth birthday in about a month. And Roi and I also had debates many, many times. And one of the... But we also had agreements that we had between us, like pacts, you know, that guys do when we were young. And one of the pacts that we had when we were very young, before we got married, is that we would always carry in our wallets, no matter where we go, a small flag of Israel. What do you call it? Fold it in our wallets. Years go by. And his third son is born. By the way, the last time I saw Roi was at his third son's bris, circumcision, nearly 8 years ago. He named him Yoav, but he's going to be eight in about a month, this Yoav guy. And his older brother just had a bar mitzvah. He was 13 a few months ago. And in the summer of 2006, the what's known as the Second Israeli-Lebanese War, which should be named the Israeli-Hezbollah War, breaks out, with the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers. And within the midst of the war, and of course everyone is called in immediately, I was in the middle of guiding a group, what's known, if you're familiar with, a birthright group. I was in the middle of guiding a birthright group. This is July 13th of 2006. And within a matter of less than 24 hours, the entire north portion of Israel, all of it, including North Gennesar, is under a severe attack of launching of rockets are falling on people's heads. We're in war. And everything ceases to exist. I mean, I was in the Dead Sea with my group. I was when I got the call. Left the group there. There's nothing you could do. Someone came to, later on, a different girl came as a tour guide to take over. But the group was at the Dead Sea. And you just leave. You go. You're called in. It's war. And during the second week of the war, there was an attempt, Israeli IDF intelligence figured out where is the headquarters of Hezbollah in a place in southern Lebanon, a place known as Bint Jbel, a certain town in southern Lebanon. And there was a plan of attacking to put an end of the launching of rockets on Israel. There was a plan of how to attack that particular headquarters of Bint Jbel. And the date was set for a certain Wednesday, July 25th, 2006. 3 days before this operation, certain units of intelligence have to be sent into this particular places to prepare all kinds of preparations of what's known as, diversion operations before the actual forces will come in. Because this is a huge town. When I say town, you understand it's a big city, just named town. Packed with Hezbollah terrorists. It just so happened to be that I was on one of those missions with my unit, I'm in intelligence, going in to that particular town, Bint Jbel, some 48, a bit more than 48 hours before the actual attack will begin. And in the Israeli army, you should know, which I think is really brilliant, it's on a need-to-know basis. People that are in a certain unit will never know anything, well, not never, but if you are in a certain, I would say, if you are preparing, okay, if you're in an intelligence unit, for instance, and you are preparing for an attack or an operation that will take place, you don't know which unit will be sent in there. You just know that it's going to be happening. You have to deliver the intelligence. They don't know who delivered the intelligence. It's on a need-to-know basis, sometimes, the way it should be. And give the intelligence, and we're sent away to a different location. And on the night of the decision of the IDF headquarters to strike at Bint Jbel, Roi, as an officer, as a commander, captain at the time, directions. He was supposed to come from a certain direction behind a place named Maru Naras towards Bint Jbel up a hill. To make a bit of a long story short, he divides his unit into, sends one commander that is under his command, one officer, to go in one direction. He goes in another, and he receives, he gets a call, or they tell him on the radio that force was attacked and they're severely injured, and there's some soldiers there, and also the commander is down. He takes six soldiers with him to decide and go to assist them. He figures out what he needs to do there. This is pitch black. It's dark. It's night. It's war. They're in a position where he figures out finally how to break through in order to get to that particular force. He's in the middle of briefing his soldiers. And in the midst of the briefing of his soldiers, a grenade is thrown in the midst of where he's briefing his soldiers. Well, he has about 2 seconds to make one of the most important one of the most, I would say, a decision that one cannot make. I mean, how do you come to this decision? There's the grenade. There are your children in front of your eyes. You have your beautiful wife, beloved wife, and children back home as well. I will never know what was going through his head in the last 2 seconds. But Roy decides to jump on the grenade. Take it in. And as the grenade goes off, Roy shouts, calls out, cries out the words, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. That is what I mean. It is part of life and death. It is part of what, at least for me, and I'm assuming for Roy as well, part of who we are and what we felt. Roy did not die that moment. There were a few, he had a few more commands to give. He goes on the radio, by the way, and calls to inform his commanders, Klein is down. Klein is down. So they know. And Roy will die just a few minutes later. I've never attended, I did not attend Roy's funeral. Unfortunately, he was still in the war. But on the third day of the Shiva, the sitting Shiva, sitting 7 days, I came to his family in Ra'anana. And his mother told me that in his wallet, when they were clearing out his wallet, in the wallet, they found that Israeli flag folded, which is the same Israeli flag that I carry till this very day. Well, not the same Israeli flag. I'm holding mine. They have his in my wallet at every given moment. And for me, I don't see any difference between this flag or the Torah or the essence of Hashem. I'm going to ask you all to rise to stand up now because the siren will be going off in about 5 to 7 seconds.
My brother.
Where are you?